Welcome to the Trevor Turnbull Show, where you'll hear vulnerable, honest stories that will inspire you to embrace your mess and live your best life. Hey everyone, welcome to the show. My guest today is Michael Heschen. So Michael and I have known each other. I've known Michael now for like 3 years or so. And he is a former client who's now a client again. He's a part of a group that we put together, a collective, where everybody is really coming with the intent on embodying their highest self. And, you know, it really manifests and shows up as every single person challenging beliefs, being surrounded by other people that are committed to that greatest version of themselves, knowing that they are actually enough, and leaning into that work. And then, of course, it takes the shape in the physical form of, you know, showing up online, sharing your truth, speaking about what it is you know that you believe that you can help others with, and that by not doing so, you're actually robbing those people of your gifts. And that was one of the things that we talked about here on this interview, is that Michael has a background in history in the financial space. He's a person that has owned businesses, sold businesses, and he is now a practitioner in the, or a registered consultant, I believe is what he called it, in the infinite banking concept. And what he does is he works with clients to be able to help them get these policies that allow them to withdraw money from the policies so that they can actually use it right now. So if you think about this from like a standard insurance policy, like a term insurance policy, which I am not an expert in by any means, but this is why you're going to want to listen to this interview. But a term policy, you pay into it, it's low fees, essentially, but you have some peace of mind that if something unfortunately happens to you, that your loved ones are taken care of. There's other types of these policies as well, and one of them are these whole life policies. And Michael broke down how you can actually leverage these so that you can really take advantage of the money that you are making now and put it to use, as opposed to waiting until you retire or waiting until you unfortunately pass away, and then the money actually gets released. And we dove deep on the why behind this, as well as why there's just such a hesitancy by the financial industry, you know, your mortgage broker, your mutual fund broker, your financial advisor, to actually recommend these types of policies and to do the work that's required to set them up for the average person. You know, somebody that is earning a decent living, somebody that owns property, that type of thing. That was one of the things Michael and I talked about, is like, who is this right for? Because there are certain thresholds that you're going to have to meet as far as like income and how much you got coming in versus going out and all that kind of stuff. And we dove into that. But it's just one of those things where once you start to crack the nut open or peek the proverbial door open of like, wait a second, that doesn't sound like anything that I learned in school or what they talk about on the news or what my financial advisor is talking about. You now have two choices to go, well, it must be crazy and this just, you know, is kind of like on the fringe kind of thing. Or you go, wait a second, I need to go explore this further. There seems like there's something here. And Michael was able to break down things very granularly. And I did ask him questions from my own perspective of not having a lot of knowledge in this space. So hopefully my questions are the same ones that you would ask as well, just around, wait a second, I wasn't sure about that. Can you go deeper? And yeah, he did such a great job of really explaining that, as well as speaking about his why. Like, why this? You know, why is he actually doing this? Why is he committed to trying to help people take control of their banking, their wealth, you know, and really their peace, financial peace of mind for now and in the future. So let's go ahead and give this one a listen. All right, Michael Heschen.
Hey, Trevor.
How's it going, my friend?
Thank you.
So good to be talking to you. Yeah. Yeah, I've been looking forward to talking to you. Obviously, we have known each other for a few years now, and we talk fairly frequently now because we're working together. But, you know, as I've got to know you more, and not only just the business that you're in, but also who you are as a person, I'm just curious about diving even deeper into that story of what brought you to this point and why you're so passionate about what you do. And of course, for me, I would have introduced you in an introduction video prior to us actually hopping on here, but I'm actually very curious about the idea of how I can manage my money and grow my money and grow my wealth and do it in a way where I'm not, you know, dependent on some of these, we'll call it archaic systems that seemingly exist in this world of how you invest in yourself. And I know you've got a lot of knowledge to share on that. So yeah, I'm looking forward to tapping into your brain here a little bit and finding out who Michael is a little bit deeper. So really quickly, before we do get into that, and I'll have you introduce yourself to everyone. There's a quote by Brené Brown that I like to say out loud to everybody when we start, and it just kind of sets the context for the intention of the podcast interview and all that kind of stuff. So it goes like this: one day you will tell your story of how you overcame what you went through, and it will be somebody else's survival guide. So I say that out loud just to kind of ground us in, hey, you know, let's speak the truth. Let's be vulnerable and honest. Somebody's going to hear this and go, kind of like that Michael guy, and who knows where the rest of it will take people. So with that, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about who you are and what brought you here. You know, why'd you decide to even do the interview with me?
Okay, so I live in Rhode Island, the smallest state in the Union. And how far back should I go?
Whatever you feel like you need to, and I'll prompt you on some questions if I want you to go deeper.
I think as far as what led me to this point, a couple of years out of college, I started my first business. I knew a lot of things I didn't want to do, and I was fortunate that my old man, who I was very close to, had a business brokerage, and he, you know, buy and sell mostly small businesses, and so he was exposed to a lot of different types, everything from restaurants to little, you know, antique stores to everything in between. And he came across someone who had a boat canvas shop. And I did a lot of sailing. And he thought, oh, well, you know, I know you don't want to wear a suit. I know you like to be outside. You like working with your hands and you like boats. Maybe this would work. So we didn't buy it. What we did, we had the guy train me and teach me how to do it. So I had my own business. Started with my dad, and he unfortunately passed away a few years into it. But I did that for 16 years. So I got to experience having my own thing and loved it, you know, the freedom behind it. But at the same time, looking back on it, I just burned out and I shut it down. So I didn't really have an escape plan or anything like that. I didn't really want to, you know, because I was making stuff by hand and they were paying for my expertise. And I just didn't really want to, like, create a business with employees. I just didn't trust that they would be as diligent as I was about it, you know?
Yeah, so, passionate, work, go the extra mile, all that stuff. How could we possibly expect people to, right?
Yeah.
It's not their business.
I read the Kiyosaki book, you know, The Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And a real realization that, oh, okay, I just own my own job. I didn't. My own business, but I really just owned my job. I didn't have any leverage. If I didn't go to work, nothing got done because it was all on me. And it was a real eye-opener. And around that time, the first house my wife and I bought was a rental unit. It was a two-unit. So we started to experience, like, oh, that's pretty cool. We can buy this house to tenant, help pay the mortgage. And we got a really good deal on it. So we started, and then I got into stocks and currencies trading and stuff like that when I shut my business down. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be an investor. So I used 2006 before the 2008 debacle. And then I just learned a ton just about, you know, the money flow that happens out there between governments overnight, banks overnight, just it flows back and forth, and how the currency market's the biggest one on the planet. And it was really cool. But I found that I got to a point where I didn't like the fact that it was a zero-sum game, meaning that when you had a big winner, you know, someone else got screwed over here in the trading space of it, not so much the long-term investor. And then just to see the chicanery, you know, just with, like, I'd be in trading and you could see that, like, hedge funds would get information a second before I did, because it could spend money and get, you know. So I just, all these things kind of led to when I learned about infinite banking, just how much control and how safe it is. And it was just a real eye opener. It's just like all these things that sort of led up to it.
And the business, so the business that you own right now is called Infinite Banking, right?
Well, that's a, so what that is, that's Infinite Banking Concepts is created by this guy named Nelson Nash. And basically what he figured out, and he wrote a book back in 2000 called Becoming Your Own Banker. And he coined that phrase because his thing was, if you learn how to utilize these very specific types of whole life insurance policies that people have been doing for hundreds of years and just kind of forgot that you could do cool things with it other than leave a death benefit to your loved ones, that you could put the banking function in your own life and start to stop that pattern of always having to borrow from outside lenders, losing interest, and really having a hard time getting ahead. So it's really about, and the infinite part is once you start doing it and start becoming your own lender, the possibilities are really infinite. And so I'm a practitioner.
That's the name.
But a lot of people don't really understand. That's why he called it that. And so I'm certified through the Nelson Nash Institute as an infinite banking concept practitioner. There's only a couple hundred in the States. They want to make sure people are doing it the right way. But my business is, you know, is peaceful, financial peace of mind with Michael R. Heschen. That's my website. That's sort of my tagline, as it were. So I'm an authorized infinite banking concept practitioner, and that's my business name.
Gotcha. Okay. So one of the things that I was looking forward to talking to you about this topic on, or the reason why, is because there's still an element for me that's kind of like, this sounds interesting, but what? And I kind of want to play in that role too, like from a straight up honest place to say, you know, ask you some of the questions a little bit more granular, because people that are going to be watching this too, I think, first of all, I want us to maybe ground in the why, which we already started talking about, of like the banking system and how things seem to be kind of rigged almost, you know, like if you got the in, then you got the in, or if you've got the money, well, then you have the ability to make more money. But for the average person and the average person that's, you know, financially well off, we'll say, right? Like, I don't know. And maybe that's one of the first questions I'll ask you is like, does this system actually work for somebody that's maybe like right out of college with a bunch of debt versus somebody who owns their own home or has a bunch of assets or has liquid cash versus all their money tied up in real estate or something, right? Like, these are the first questions that come to mind. So let's maybe start with that. This infinite banking system, who is it for? Like, who can actually take advantage of this?
Obviously you have to be making more than your, more needs to be coming in than going out.
Step one.
So you have to have some discretionary income. It's interesting. If you look at it, I would say middle to up, middle class, if whatever that constitutes, you know, 50, 60K and up a year, whatever that in the US, the key is, and one of my jobs is to, I'll run an analysis and I'll usually be able to identify some money to get started. On the lower end, U.S. dollars for an individual, adult, let's call it, you know, 20 or above, 25 or above, 10,000 per year. So, you know, $800 a month, give or take, right, to start with. And you can go lower than that. But so when you think of it that way, it's not outlandish. And a lot of people I'll find they might be sending money into a 401k or some government program. And I'll actually show them, like, if you let's theoretically stop doing that and start your first policy, and let's show you what that would do. So that's sort of the so I would say, you know, middle and then upper middle class and then as high as you want to go. You don't have to be super wealthy to do it. But you have to, you know, have some ability to set us and put, you know, money to work. And the thing too is, it's not just setting money aside and not touching it, which is the case with 401ks and whatnot. You can't touch it unless it's like an emergency, or I think sometimes they'll let you tap into for mortgage purposes. But otherwise, you got to wait till you're 59 and a half in the U.S.
Yeah. So and then you're still paying tax on it when you actually do.
When they take it out, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And that's their angle, is that, oh, you don't pay taxes, you don't pay it till later. And Nelson's whole thing was, you need money all throughout your life. You finance everything you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in one way or the other, you can set aside money and pay cash for it. Then the money that's being set aside to pay cash is not earning anything. It's just sitting there until you can afford the car or whatever it is, and then you start over again. Or you get a loan out from some institution, pay them interest, and then get the vehicle or whatever, but you're losing outside interest. I think on average in the U.S., it's like 34 cents of every dollar spent goes to interest. That's a lot. That's more than a third of every buck that you spend on average goes just to satisfy interest payments. And it's hard to get ahead, you know. So,
yeah, and this is probably the most intriguing part of this too, that because honestly, Michael, I feel like I've had conversations like this with other people before. Like, naturally, I'm in Canada, you're in the US, so there's probably going to be some, you know, some legalities and stuff that might be slightly different. In fact, is there? I'll just ask you that question. Is it slightly different on how you can use this type of whole life insurance versus in Canada versus US?
You can do it. There are practitioners in Canada who are certified by the Nelson Nash Institute as well. My understanding is it's you get taxed more on it. It's not as tax advantaged as it is in the U.S.
Yep. And can you
still good, but not as good. Like I said to you, if you own some businesses, you could set up a corporate entity in the U.S. You could run your policies through that, and it'd just be better.
What about other countries too? Is it like, I'll give you an example here. So let me just explain where I'm coming from on this. So my wife and I are moving our family down to Costa Rica, and naturally there's lots of reasons, the sunshine, the surf, the education, all of that kind of stuff, the good vibes, but it's also partly the taxes and the government's, quite frankly, too. You know, I just put out a post talking about this, and while I'm not doing it to say like, we're leaving because our government's corrupt, and it's like, I kind of look at it now. Where I might have thought like the government's screwing me and I don't agree with what they're doing and therefore they're ruining my life. And then I thought, wait a second, I'm in control of my life. But there are policies that get put in place that ultimately put us into a rock and a hard place here, right? And when it comes to the taxes, like Canada, Canadians pay a ton of tax, and it differs based on provinces too. So we actually pay a ton of tax because it's the highest taxed, maybe the highest or the second highest taxed province in all of Canada. So naturally, we started thinking, okay, well, let's leave, right? Well, what does that look like now? So you start talking to accountants and you're figuring out, like, how can you actually not have to pay tax in Canada? If we're not going to be here, why do we got to pay taxes here for services that we're not using, for roads that we're not driving on, all of that kind of stuff? So we've looked into, you know, Costa Rica. We've looked into Barbados or Bahamas or some, one of those two. I can't remember, just for the corporate tax benefits. But, why I'm most curious about this too, though, is just exactly that. It's like, okay, so where do we set up our banking? Because maybe a U.S. corporation is something that might be of interest, but every time I've explored it, I've kind of hit roadblocks. But I think Delaware is actually the one state in the U.S. that's like the most advantageous if you're going to set up a corporation, isn't it? Or is it Rhode Island?
No, not Rhode
Island. It's not Rhode Island. I think it's Delaware. Yeah.
Delaware is one, like Wyoming, Utah, or some of the obvious ones who don't have like income tax. And, you know, I'm not sure if Delaware does or not, but yeah, they're known for advantages like that. Yeah, I know, because you're planning on keeping your house in Canada, right?
We are for now, but that's another piece of it, is that as we look into like residency and then even citizenship, I know there's one difference between the U.S. and Canada. And I don't know all the tax laws on this, but apparently it doesn't matter where you live or work as an American, you pay tax in the States. Like, that's it. Like, you pay it. Whereas Canada is a little bit different. Like, we can go, and as long as we're not making income in Canada, then we don't have to pay tax on it. You know, the house, yes, we'll have to pay on that. And we have no plans on giving up citizenship, I don't believe, but anyways, yeah, that's kind of the rabbit hole we're down right now. So this, what we're talking about here, this infinite banking is I'm thinking maybe a piece of the puzzle. I'm just trying to wrap my head around how we could even get started with it and how it would make most sense, knowing that we're exiting the Canadian tax system, right? And we're looking at, where do we set up this next corp, right?
Yeah, I the thing with setting up a corporation in the U.S. too is that you have to have, so I have a guy, my web guy, who lives in Spain, and he's a native, he still has U.S. citizenship, and in Florida, and have an LLC set up there, but they're all in Spain now. And he was really interested in doing this for himself because he's learned about it. And he really can't because they don't – you either have to live some amount of time in that state that you're a resident in, or if you own a business and you have employees who are running it who are U.S. citizens, you can actually do business-type insurance on them as what's called key people. So that you, it's a business type where you're basically, you know, nominally it's you're taking out life insurance on the key people that run your business. If one of them were to pass, the death benefit would help cover, you know, the cost of replacing that person. But when you incorporate infinite banking into it, then it allows the owner a you know, nice cash flow option. So for you, I suspect it's going to be just getting it done in Canada as we talk more and you learn more about it. If it's something that you want to look, and then I reconnect you with one of those folks up there, and you'd want to do it before you leave, because I'm sure Canada is the same way, because you have to go through underwriting and get your blood drawn and all that kind of fun. They're fully medically underwritten. You once you're in Costa Rica, you can't do it unless you come back for a visit. You have to, you know, to get those meds done. You do have to be in, you know, so, but you, there's time. And, you know, as we talk further about it, I think that would probably make the most sense. And then, you know, does that, then it doesn't really matter what you do, because as long as you have policy or policies through a company in Canada, it doesn't matter where you move to, you can still access it. You know,
so just to be clear, then, if we were to say become residents of Costa Rica or Bahamas or Barbados and have companies set up in those countries, this is not an option. This is an American or a Canadian thing only. Is that correct?
As far as I know, it's not.
Okay, gotcha.
It's not. Well, and the reason is because these are Canadian and American insurance companies, and they have, you know, certain, you know, rules. And I know some people who have looked into companies in other countries, and they just aren't set up the same way, as far as I can tell.
Okay. Cool. Maybe you want to explain to everybody too, which is me in code saying, can you explain to me the difference between whole life and, say, term? And I think that's probably the comparables, right? Is like, we have term life insurance right now. We've got a financial advisor who we've worked with, who sat down with a whiteboard in front of me and showed me the four quadrants of investments and insurance and, you know, all of the I forget everything that he said already. It's actually something that I really lean into is the finances stuff, because I've long told myself, like, you're not good at this, ignore it, hire somebody else, take their advice, right? But that's not a good way for anybody to operate. We should all lean in and learn these basic principles. But I remember them talking to me about stuff like this, and term was ultimately the direction that we went at the time. Can you just explain the difference between the two, and if there's something else that's in the mix there that I'm just not aware of as well?
No, yeah, happy to. So term is just like it's for a period of time. So it's like the first one that my wife and I got was after our second child was born. And someone, I think it was a friend of ours, referred to some life insurance agent and said, hey, you guys should get some insurance. It strictly is protection. So we got 20-year term. You know, it was pretty cheap. We were probably, what, 30 or early 30s when our second one was born. And it was just 20 years of, it might have been $500,000 death benefit. And it just means that if one of us died and there, the other, we get a check for 500 grand. You know, and then, so those are strictly, for the most part, for protection purposes. And it's the most common type of life insurance out there because
it's cheap.
You know, it's very cheap. And they don't pay out.
No.
It's like 1%.
Yep.
Either people let them lapse or they just don't re-up again. So the industry loves them because they're cheap and they never have to pay death benefits.
Yeah, it's like a cash cow, right?
They'll have these yearly convertible or yearly term insurance policies that they can renew. So some will get, you know, maybe if they pass away, they'll get income replacement for the year. Whole life is just like the idea is that you pay for it your whole life until you're done. And that's also part of the permanent insurance space. There's other types of permanent insurance that have evolved over the last 20, 30 years called universal life and variable life. universal life is, and it's the real popular one now, is indexed universal life, where the growth component is tied to an index like the S&P 500. So they're all the rage now, partly because, especially in this country, people are just obsessed with the stock market. I mean, I love my NPR, National Public Radio, and every hour they mention how where the Dow is and where the S&P and where the NASDAQ. And it's really not that important. You know, the market goes up and it goes down.
Yeah.
You know, there's this weird fixation on the market in this country. So so they're very popular because people feel like they're participating in the growth of the market. But they're really not ideal for infinite banking, the very particular type of whole life insurance with mutual companies. So, and the reason mutual versus stock companies. So in the U.S., mutual companies just mean that they're almost like a credit union. They're not publicly owned. They don't have no shareholders. And it's really the policyholders own the company. And they access this capital freely. They're guaranteed growth within it. And we don't use public companies, publicly traded companies, because they're beholden to the stockholders and share price above and beyond anything else, really. Any stock company, they have to satisfy the shareholders, and that's usually the stock price. And in that space, something like what's going on with Twitter can happen. You know, maybe Elon will do a great job with Twitter if he does take it over. I guess he's hedging his bets a bit. He may not do it. He's kind of holding off for now. But, you know, but the point is, in a publicly traded company, any billionaire has got enough, can buy enough shares and can control the direction of that company, one individual, for good or ill. In these mutual companies, it can't happen. It's not even an option. You know, these companies I use, you know, these big banks own tons of these policies, billions of dollars of permanent insurance, like Bank of America. Even though they can't redirect and cause that company to change directions. They don't have that power. And the other thing is that it doesn't matter what the stock prices are doing, because it's not tied to it at all. So it's that sort of, you know, you don't have to worry about it. That's why I call it peace of mind, once you really understand how it works. I don't care what the market's doing. I mean, I really don't.
Yeah. Well, and I've heard you say that to me a few times, and I think that's one thing that really stands out, because in the world that we're living in right now, it seems like it's so volatile, and naturally the financial industry is the place where you see it the most, right? It's like we're going through massive inflation right now. You know, unemployment's at all-time highs, just all of these things. So it's in our face all the time in the news, and it feels like the most out of control thing in every single person's life is that security. And then naturally, everybody always defaults back to that tried, tested, and true thing, which is real estate. And then, and I'll just say this out loud, maybe you want to pick up on it too. And then you start reading articles about like BlackRock and how they're buying up like communities in Texas. This is just one of the articles I saw in like Dallas, Texas. You know, BlackRock went in and bought up like 40 houses because they were all priced at a price where the average person couldn't buy them. They could pay 40% over market value. And now they own the whole block and they rent them back to people. And when you dig deep onto that, you're like, holy shit, like this is actually very, very scary, because it seems like real estate has always kind of been that like stable, you know, you put your money into land. Okay. But then you go and you sell that place and you can't afford to get back into the damn market. Then what do? Now, naturally, well, you can move countries, but Costa Rica is not any cheaper than Canada. So we're not going there for the benefits of cheaper land. Like, that's for sure. You know, the houses are just as expensive, if not more, but there is places, you know, like you can get into a beautiful house in Mexico for a quarter of the cost of what it is here where I live. And I'm sure where you live too. But so anyways, that's, yeah, I don't know if you want to pick up on that as far as, you know, the security of where do I put my damn money, you know?
Yeah, it's a real problem. Even on a smaller level, you have a lot of local investors who are buying stuff up, which, you know, kind of affects the amount of houses that are available to people who just want to buy a home to live in it. So, yeah, it's an issue. I'm not really sure what you can do about it. It's sort of like, you saw the article I posted, I think yesterday, with that quote from that Dune, the Children of Dune book. And it's just how, whether it's, even though BlackRock's not in the government per se, there's a real tight symbiosis between government and hedge funds and Wall Street banks. You know, there's a time where you see these congressmen or cabinet members leave government, go to Goldman Sachs or something like that. And there's just a real, there's a tight relationship. And that would include BlackRock and those big hedge funds and that. It's sort of part of the that whole aristocracy, right? And a little, I don't have the quote in front of me, but this the idea is that the government gets to a point where it's just humming along, and it's mostly built to support its own version of an aristocracy, whatever that is, whether it's, you know, dukes and princes or government officials or just people who have a boatload of money, that top, you know, 1% or whatever it is. And unfortunately, they have the means and ability to do it. And I don't know if regular people can do much about it other than try to get their own version of it for themselves. And I think partly why infinite banking can work, because you can start to get, my mentor calls it creating your own economy. Because when you think about it, everybody has their own economy. They have money that comes in through work, their job, whatever, the money that goes out for various things. So each, we all individually have our own economy. There's the broader one, there's the local one, and it's sort of like get your handle on your own family economy, get it handled, and start using these private policies that have no government interference, no Wall Street impact. And, you know, that's the magic behind it. And you can start to act like a bank does, where you put money to work and you bring it back in. Work and you bring it back in. And it's compounding interest the whole time, the way these things are structured. It's all tax-free. You pay after-tax dollars on it, but it grows tax-free internally. And then you just tap into it, ideally put it back in, and it acts like a line of credit, sort of like a, it's like a hybrid line of credit savings account with a death benefit on top as the least important part of it. And it all grows, the cash portion of it grows, you know, at a healthy rate, like 3.75%. So it blows away any savings account. There's no risk. It just keeps chugging along because it's guaranteed to keep chugging along. And yeah, you know, the companies we use, they've all been around. They've all been through the ringer. Like in the U.S., you know, the oldest ones before the Civil War. So they've been through depressions and world wars and civil wars and recessions, and they're still doing great and really strong. So there's another reason why we use them. They're very stable. They're actually very conservative in how they grow their stuff, but they're really good at it. And it's just yeah, I probably told you this great story of Walt Disney back in the 50s. When he wanted to start his first Disney World, the one in California, the banks wouldn't lend him any money. And he had cash value in his policies and was able to help start Disney World because he called the insurance company and said, hey, I'm not sure how much money, it might have been $100,000, which would have been a lot of money back then. And they're like, yeah, sure, let's send him a check. Whereas the bank was like, nah, you're too much of a risk. We're not going to.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I can relate. 17 years as an entrepreneur, I got my first loan ever from a bank, which was a BDC in Canada, so Business Development Canada, which is very pro-entrepreneur, 4 years ago. So it took me, 13 years to actually get that loan. And it was just because right place, right time, the government was giving out a boatload of money and all you had to do was apply. But everything up until then was, geez, you did 700K last year? I don't know. It still sounds risky. It's like, what? How is that possible? You know? But, and that's where, when you start running into those situations too, I know for me, like if I'm just being honest, it was frustrating. Like there were so many times where I just thought, this is insanity. You know, if I went and got a job right now, they would line up to give me money. They really would. You know, they'd line up to give me credit cards. They'd line up to give me all this debt financing. But the minute you actually start to take control of your own destiny and your own finances, then they lock it down, which just seems backwards. And anyways, you got me thinking of three other questions here. So I'm going to ask them one at a time here, because this is good. One of them is just around this idea of like being in your own bank and being able to access the money, because that's the part that I think I understand the whole life insurance policies give you the leverage to do, right? Is that you can essentially pay into this and then you can actually draw out the money as well. Can you draw the full amount at any time? And then this follow-up question to that is, I know you mentioned that there's no risk, but we've talked about this before where I think you said it out loud to me a couple months ago. You have to pay your bills. You know what I mean? For lack of a better term, it's like, look, you can't just keep drawing out money. Like, you got to be making sure that you're staying on top of all of your debts and your bills and everything else. So do you want to maybe speak to that of some more of the specifics as much as you're able to publicly? I don't know how much of this you could talk about publicly.
Yeah, sure. So, let me go. The first thing was about, so if it's a straight, people like Dave Ramsey's out of the world there who think IBC, infinite banking, is a joke, and they just don't know what they're talking. He doesn't know what he's talking about. So if you think of a regular whole life policy, if you don't design it the way I know how to design it, eventually you'll get cash value that you can tap into. You can either pull it out or take loans out against it, but it can take a while because you think about it. The insurance company is most at risk early on. Say if someone has $1 million death benefit for a whole life policy, you know, the first few years, the company is really exposed in that one contract because the person dies and maybe they've only put, you know, a couple $1,000 or whatever.
And now they're paying out.
And they have a check. So it takes a while, but the way we design it is, one way to think about it, let's use a round number, 10,000, like a smaller one. The way I set it up is I have about 60 to 70% of that 10 total per year annual premium goes into something called the cash surrender value. It's part of the mechanics of these contracts. And I put that amount in because if you put too much in, it becomes less, it's not tax advantage. So you have to find a sweet spot. If there's too much money in early that's accessible cash value, and the ratio to death benefit is off, the IRS is like, all right, you're not trying, this isn't death benefit, this is you're trying to get, you're just trying to use a cash machine. So they make you do it in such a way that you can't put too much in. So, but generally speaking, 60 to 70% or so of whatever you put in on an annual basis is available capital to do whatever you want with it. So I'll give you an example. The first one that we did, my wife and I, was 9 years ago. We had a chunk of money that came from my father-in-law's having passed and part of his estate being liquidated. And we had about, I think it was $24,000. And we had some high interest credit card debt. And I just learned about these things. I said, we should do one on my wife, on her life. And because we still had our terms at the time, the term insurance, but they were close to being done. And she's healthier than me. I figured, you know, let's do it on you. And she was making more money too. It made more sense. So of the $24,000, what we did was we said, okay, four of that is going to be the ongoing base premium. Like for that's the whole life part. You keep paying that $4,000 per year. 20 of it went into as a one-time payment into the cash value. It's hard to do that much now, but we were able to do it then. And almost all that 20 became available to do something. So what we did, you don't pull it out of there. You take a loan out from the company. These companies, they have this pool of money that they hold on to. It's not in a bank. It's incredibly safe. All the premiums, there's a pool of money that these companies have. You have a cash value, and they go, okay, you've got 20 in there. We'll lend you $19,000. So you take a loan out, like 4% low interest loan from the company. We pay off the debt. The thing is, someone may say, well, why not just pay off the credit card debt with the cash you had, right? Well, the reason, then that money's gone. We could either run up those credit cards again at 18, 20%, whatever it was, and do the whole thing over again. But by getting it into our asset first, the new whole life policy, taking a loan out, paying off the debt, and then cycling our money back into it, then we just do it for the next thing. And that's how you start to run like a bank. You use the same dollar over and over again. So we're able to take that $20,000, put it in there, use it, cycle it back in, use it again for some other debt or whatever. And that's just think about, that's how banks make their money. They have money, they lend it out, it comes back to them at interest. Lend it out, bring it back. So you start to do that for yourself. And that's really the gist of it. And the more, you need to be disciplined, but the thing is, these loans, you don't have to pay them back. They don't put you on a payment plan. In Canada, they might. We'll have to check on
that. So it's kind of like a line of credit, and forgive my ignorance if I'm just speaking out loud and out my butt, but
it's like a hybrid savings account, line of credit with a death benefit too. That's growing the whole time. And it's all tax-free, the growth in it.
A question that comes to mind here, Michael, is so what happens in the unfortunate circumstance that you've, say, borrowed against the money that you've put in, a good chunk of it, you know, and you happen to die? What happens then? Like, does the company say, like, look, you got to pay that back before we'll actually pay the policy out? Or do they actually pay out the policy using the policy to pay off the debt that was actually borrowed? Does that make sense?
No, they subtract it. That's
okay.
Simple.
Okay. So is the latter one that I said there. Yeah, it's like you're not.
You say it's like a bigger one, like $100,000. Yeah. And, you know, I don't have the biggest one I have is like a $50,000. And yeah, if you took out, say you had $100,000, or say that they'd been into it for 5 years. And there was, you know, well, actually, let's call it 4 years. Because remember, I only do that full amount for the first 4 years. And then you back off and you stop putting that 60 or 70% in because you don't need to. And I can get into that later. But so you put that money in. You take out, let's say you take out, you know, $200,000 in loans and then you die. They're fine. They just subtract the $200,000 from the, say, it's $1 million debt map. It's the safest kind of loan they can do because it's collateralized by the death benefit that they're on the hook for. And if you let the policy lapse, they'll go, okay, if you took out more in loans than you paid in the base premium portion, then there might be a taxable event if you let it lapse. So when I talk to people, I say, look, you do it this way. If you do that, you front load it for 4 years, whatever that number is, and then you back off and only pay that 40 or 30%. Because at that point, every buck you're putting in there, you get more than a dollar back. It'd be like if you could walk into a bank and say, here's 10 bucks, I'm going to put it in savings. And you go back a day later and say, hey, I want to take that out. And in the case of a bank, it's going to be the same amount because it would have earned like maybe 0.01% or something. But in the case of this, at this point, you get like $1.25 back. And then it keeps getting bigger and bigger over time because you're the compounding interest, the way these things are structured. Can I share a quick story?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So
we love stories. That's how people let these messages land.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a real life version of that Walt Disney story I mentioned earlier. So I have a client who's a veterinarian doctor up in Illinois, and great guy. He's paid three payments of $50,000 a year so far for his whole life policy. He didn't need to really tap into it. And as we were looking at it, these things always perform better. So I put together an illustration to say, look, this is what it's going to look like. You put this premium in, the guaranteed growth, the dividends. These companies, they all pay dividends. They don't guarantee them, but they do. They've been doing them for over 100 years. We have them, the dividends, buy more insurance, which keeps it taxable free and makes the whole thing grow bigger. It's just another component of it. So in his case, he paid $50,000 in, didn't need it for anything, had no debt. Second year, he put another $50,000 in. And in his case, 30%, that 30 of the 50 was going into the cash value, right, that he could tap into. So the second year, we looked at it together and he's like, I should have about $60,000 available, right, to borrow against. And it was like 72. And it's like, wait a minute, how did that happen? I go, it's just, these things they're designed to generate early cash value. So this past payment a year ago, in the meantime, he bought a new business, a kennel, like a boarding place. And really cash flow positive, he and his wife, he just got remarried about a year ago. And he needed about $110,000 to close the deal. So he calls me and he says, hey, should I pay my next $50,000 premium first and then take a loan out to help close the business deal? And I said, yes.
Yes.
Or should I pay the $50,000? It'd be kind of like with the credit card. If you just taken the $50,000 he had and just paid it to business, yes, the business is going to generate money. But, you know, by putting it in there first, so he put it in, right? So he's put in a total of $150,000. Really, 30 times 3, $90,000 of it goes into that special cash value, get $120,000 available to borrow against. How did that happen? So we put 90 into that part of the contract, and there's 120. It's just how it works. So he called him up and he said, hey, I need $110,000. And like, okay, it's a large enough amount where we need to have you fax something. Just, you know, because it's, you know, usually when it's a smaller amount, like for me, it might be 10, 20 grand when I take a loan out. I just do it electronically. I get it within a couple of days. In this case, he faxed the form in, and he got electronic funds transfer 2 days later, went and closed the deal on his business. And now he's still got that asset over here. The money's not gone. So he's just going to cycle. He knows he's really cash flow positive on his business. And I said, just pay off the loan. And then next year, you'll have a ton of money you could use to pay the next 50 premium if you don't have a new like 50 grand available. So it becomes full self. My wife and I have 9 of these things, policies. And it's part of our system. And, you know, I know you have kids, and one of the great things is that my daughters, we own them, and they're part of our banking system. But eventually, I'll teach them how to do it, and they'll have, you know, by the time I hand it over to them, it'll be a few thousand dollars a year. And they could have, you know, a $250,000 death benefit and, you know, 120, 200 grand of cash value growing tax-free they can tap into. You know, so that's where the whole intergenerational thing comes into it as well.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
I heard you just a second ago say we own them, and you were referencing the policies, but I thought you meant your daughters. We own them.
No,
that's funny.
We do let them. We've had our youngest living here because she was in Australia during the pandemic, barely got out of there in time. She's been living at home. She works as a nanny locally, and my other one, the older one, live locally, and they just have to move out. So she has to come home. We're going to have a full house. You're trying to get rid of them. And you're a long ways away from that. They keep coming back.
Yeah.
But, you know, given the times, it's okay. Tough out there. They had a place locked up to go look at in the rental. And someone came in and said, hey, we'll come rent it sight unseen. And the guy's like, okay, sure. And he calls my broker, sorry.
It's the reality that we're living in right now. Like it's one of those things that people see it and feel it when they're actually in that situation. But I could even say with our place here, like we're going to be renting our place and, you know, we're almost going to get double our mortgage costs for just the upstairs of our house. And that was only after owning this place for 4 years. And I just think to myself, man, it must be tough for people because, you know, it's not a small chunk of change just to live nowadays, and you're getting outbid on properties and rentals and everything. And anyways, that's why this conversation is important. And there's a couple other things that came to mind here, Michael, too, because I want to sit in that seat of like, ooh, this sounds interesting, but what about this? And the first thing that comes to mind is the whole crypto space, right? So maybe we could touch on that a little bit. You know, Ray Dalio just came out with a video because he wrote a new book, The Changing World Order, I want to call it, I think is the name of the book. And he just talked about the fiat system, you know, the money system and how it's changed from like the Dutch and to the British to the US and what these curves, like the economics, tell us of what's going on. And, you know, and there's a lot of depth on that. In fact, I'll probably link it up to this video because I think it'd just be interesting for people to see. But what about the crypto space? Like, how does that impact this, that what we're talking about here, as much as you can speak about? Because obviously there's a lot of unknown in all of that, too.
Yeah, I really don't think it impacts it at all. I think if anything, they're starting to dip their toes in it. So MassMutual, which is one of the largest mutual insurance companies that I use, that's been around since before the Civil War, so like 1850 or somewhere in there, they made a big play on Bitcoin about a year and a half ago, as part of their portfolio. So they, as I said before, they take in the premiums, but you know, you think about all these death benefits that they're responsible for, at some point, they have to grow and invest their money in things to grow their portfolio. The difference is they're not like a hedge fund or Goldman Sachs back in the day speculating on mortgage-backed securities. They're doing like very safe corporate bonds, government bonds, certain real estate deals. But MassMutual made a decent sized play on the future of Bitcoin as part of that. So that got my attention. I don't think it's really going to impact it that much. I think as it gets more incorporated, the cryptocurrencies into almost like a hybrid of the fiat system we have now, or maybe it overtakes it eventually. I think what will happen is that companies will say, yeah, you can pay in crypto. Sure, you want to pay your – right now you can't. You have to pay for dollars current. I could see that changing over time. But I don't think it really impacts it that much, because you think about, you know, how long these things have been around. It's just how you pay for that, the premiums. And I think at some point they'll probably take crypto at some point.
Yeah.
As a way to pay.
Yeah, and I think it'll be interesting to see how government actually gets their hands in on this space too. And you're already starting to see the moves happening, right? Where they're trying to regulate the space, and naturally the whole idea of crypto is decentralization. And like, it's going to be an interesting kind of dynamic here over the next number of years. And
what you just said is really interesting. It's because in a lot of ways, these mutual insurance companies are DeFi already, because they are regulated. You know, they have to have certain things, you know, like that I said before, there was back in the, it's kind of a, you have to keep these things inside and keep them tax advantaged and designed in the right way, so there's not too much cash that turns it into this thing that's called a modified endowment contract. And it's interesting, real quick story if I have a minute. So back in the 80s, Ronald Reagan was the last president before Trump to change the tax code in the U.S., and in the 80s, he made changes to it. Once they were implemented, it made certain, I think it was real estate investment approaches, really not so good anymore for really wealthy people. So their advisors started saying, look, take your cash and dump it into these whole life policies. One premium, like $10 million, stick it in there. You'll get a big death benefit, and you'll have a bunch of cash growing, and they're tax-free you can tap into. And it didn't take long for the IRS to go, whoa, you can't do that anymore. It really, they're like, we got to do, and they created this thing called a modified endowment contract. And it just means there has to be a proper ratio of the which money is going where in the first years of the policy. So I have to design them in a very particular way. But outside of that, once you have a contract, it's a private contract between you and a private company. When you go, let's say somebody has some of these policies and they want to get college funding, in the U.S. at least, you have to show assets. You don't have to show, you have a boatload of cash value in your policies and still want to get some, you know, some financing. You don't have to tell them about the cash in your policy. It's a very private contract. So it just occurred to me, it's sort of like an old school version of DeFi, because it's been around so long. It's monitored by the government, but within them, what you do with them is between you and the insurance company. I think there's a real natural sort of compatibility. I do have crypto clients that we use. I mean, it's more about like showing them a place to have a warehouse of wealth in the whole life policies as they're taking out their profits and stuff like that. It's sort of like this kind of symbiotic safe thing to go along with the speculative side of things.
Gotcha.
They work really nicely.
Man, this has got me thinking about all kinds of stuff. But I got two main questions for you left here. One is, why isn't everybody doing this? And you mentioned Dave Ramsey earlier, you know, and he's just one example. Dave Ramsey, right?
Dave Ramsey, yeah.
Dave Ramsey, yeah. I just want to make sure I got his name right. But, you know, obviously somebody that has a lot of influence in how people invest their money, right? He's got a lot of reach with his voice. And yeah, so why doesn't everybody have this? Like, speak. I want you to speak out loud about that, because I know we've had conversations about this with regards to the financial space and just how it works and functions. And I'll just leave it at that and give you the floor to say, like, why doesn't everybody have these?
No, it's. I'll say, I think there are a few reasons. I think one of the main reasons is that starting in the 1970s, when 401k was created before then, but they became really popular around that time, where they started to become, there was like a move away in the U.S. from pensions, like guaranteed pensions from companies, to stock market related. And these qualified plans, and where these companies could offer these qualified plans to people for retirement. So I think what happens is you have a whole generation or generations of financial professionals who are encouraged, and I was, to get my securities license and handle securities, because there's more money in it. Because all you have all these 401ks that have been, you know, around for, they started, I think back in the 60s or 40s or something, but they've been really like predominant for the last maybe 50 years or so and growing. So when you're in that profession, you're encouraged to go that route because that's where the money is. You know, securities, you know, it's all stock market related. You can manage money. People can hand a portfolio to you. You can stick it in a fund and earn some fees. And they are not taught how these life insurance contracts work. In their world, that's strictly a piece of the puzzle for safety and for, you know, just in case the worst happens. So that's one of the main reasons. So you have a whole bunch of professionals out there who don't have a clue that you can do what we teach people how to do. That's one part of the problem. And also, I think the industry after that, in the 80s, when that those changes occurred and it became less advantageous to sort of focus on the financing part, the growth part of those policies, and focus on the protection part. So I think the industry was sort of forced to focus on that, on the death benefit for your loved ones. And that, you know, if you listen, that's all they talk about. Because that's what keeps the tax advantages in place, the tax-free money to your loved one. And it's almost like they're afraid to focus on the growth component of it because they don't want to piss off the IRS. It seems that way to me. You know, even some of the companies like MassMutual is perfectly fine with infinite banking professionals. They don't really tout it. They don't talk about it much. They just let you do it. There are other companies that we use that have been around as long or longer than them that are totally fine with it, you know, with us teaching our clients to do this because it's still such a small number. So it's a combination of things, just that focus on the stock market and anything related to it that's just rampant in this country. And there aren't that many people. And another thing I will say, so when Nelson wrote that book, his goal was to have professionals like myself disseminate it to their clients. They look, you should look at doing this as part of what you're doing or all of what you're doing, whatever. When you set these policies up in the right way for the client, we actually take a significant hit in our commission by doing it the right way, by having that much cash available. We take a bath on our commission. I think there are a lot of professionals who learn that and go, I don't want to do that.
Yep, no doubt.
I'm not going to tell. And by the way, those index universal life policies that I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of people out there professing to do infinite banking and putting them in those things, which is not really appropriate because it doesn't have guarantees and they make more money on it. So it's a combination of all these things, you know, and people just sort of sheep herd mentality.
Totally. Totally.
You know, people just like, I'll just do what I'm told and money's scary. I don't want to learn about money. It's, you know, it's not that hard.
Yeah. Well, it's like I said, you know, like I don't know how much of that was instilled in me through the education system. Even by the time I got to university, I just found the really smart looking girl in the class and I made sure that she was my partner on the group projects and I passed, you know, but then I never paid attention to it. And then I ran businesses for like 10 years and just kind of figured it out, but not in a very efficient way. And then eventually I was like, I should probably understand how this whole thing works. So that was an eye opener, but it was because you just start asking the right questions and you get around the right people that start telling you something different. And you're like, wait a second, that's not what I was taught. And if you have the ability and the bravery to go, maybe there's something here as opposed to like, you're crazy, this is crazy. But I think the biggest thing that stood out to me was what you said there of, okay, if your financial guy is incentivized to sell something where he or she earns a higher commission off of something, they will sell that thing. And there's parallels in the medical world too, because that was what I was thinking when you were talking there is like, what's the problem with the medical system right now? You know, and this is my own personal opinion, but we always talk about the influence of pharmaceuticals and stuff. And you think about like a life insurance policy that pays out at end of life. Well, it doesn't actually enrich your life right now. You know, it's just a risk reduction to say that you won't leave somebody with this massive burden of debt, right? And they get some cash to help them live a better life. But after you're gone, you're dead already. You know what I mean? And the same thing feels like that with the medical system. It's like, imagine if we, from the moment that you were educated as a kid, learned how to take care of yourself and live your best life, and policies were put in place to make it illegal to sell fast food or whatever. Like, that sounds extreme, but, you know, we tax the shit out of fast food instead of just cigarettes and booze, you know? And this stuff just, it gets me passionate because when you start looking at the whole system, you start to realize that the whole thing's broken. And the only way that you fix it is to speak out loud about it and everybody to make different decisions and to choose to see something that once you open the door, because this feels just like that. It's kind of like the spiritual journey that I know both of us are on right now. You peek that door open and you're like, wait a second. And you have a choice at that point. I don't want to see that. No. Or you're like, okay, fine. Let's go. Let's see what's behind this door. And it's scary. It's scary for people because it's almost like everything that they believe to be true is now no longer true. And how could that be possible? Because the mass population is believing, you know, what everybody else believes.
Yeah, and it's just institutional. It's not like, you know, the bankers, the mortgage brokers, you know, we talked about this before, you know, the whole industry, the mortgage industry is geared to have people keep refinancing their homes. And talk about how great it is. Yeah, you just, every time you do, you just add interest on the back end of you're just throwing more money into the mortgage, you know, the bank or lender. And it makes it sound like it's this wonderful thing. And they're even sort of swimming in this ether. I've learned these other things that you can do that most people don't have a clue about. And it's just like the, you know, the system. It's sort of been systematized that way. And it doesn't make them bad people. I know people in the mortgage industry. They're wonderful people. And they probably don't know about some of these mortgages that I can do, that I know how to do. They're not taught it. And they don't sell it. They don't know
about
it.
Yeah, it's a hierarchical.
And I think it can't be a top-down approach. There's no evidence that that works. So you got to take it and hopefully do like a bottom-up. You know, really Nelson's goal was to get, you know, some certain number of the population doing this for themselves, that then banks would have to go, wow, we're not being used as much to hold our money. They're holding all our money in these life insurance policies. Maybe we should raise the rate on our savings account so we get more, you know, stuff like that. That was sort of his goal, was like to get enough people doing this for themselves and their families that it would impact it, but from the underside, rather than hope that they'll do the right thing on the top and trickle down or whatever. You know,
or the government will just print more money and bail them out, you know, whatever works. Either way, ugh, such a crazy, crazy world. The last question I wanted to ask you, Michael, was more around the personal side. So I know you and your wife have both leaned into, like we talked about, spirituality side of things, of what both of us are actually leaning more into right now, together even. But you've done the work together as a couple and individually as well. And I know that's a big part of, I think, what makes up you and ultimately why, you know, we've worked together, quite honestly, because I feel like I attract people that are willing to lean in and do that work, because quite frankly, I don't accept anything less in my life anymore. You know, if I'm going to spend time with people, I want them to be questioning things. I want them to show up in service. You know, I want them to prioritize and make time for date night. You know, we were joking around about that before we hit record on this, but tell me the why behind this. Like, forget about the financial stuff and all of the stuff that you know intuitively, but like, why does this matter to you? Why is this the thing that you choose to spend your time on to help other people?
I think, to me, I love to teach. I think that's part of it. And I love to the idea of like my web guy said, oh, you're trying to be like Obi-Wan Kenobi, where you're a master at these things, and you want to share this with people, and you'll be sort of in the guru role for a bit, but then at some point you just let them go. And I love that, the idea behind that. And as you know, my wife and I went through bankruptcy, and I didn't mention that earlier, but 2008, and you know, we weren't set up for that whole debacle in 2008. We had rental property that started to not be cash flow positive, and it got harder to keep rented, and it became a money pit. And then I was trading in the markets, and I wasn't losing money, but it got crazy, and I just couldn't keep us out of it. So I got the experience, and that was really hard. And I'm sure if I had taken the time to get diagnosed, I probably would have been diagnosed as clinically depressed for a few years after that. So I would, with this wisdom I've learned, I would save people from that, from the money side of things. a huge component for people. If there's, you could have something in place where you're not so at risk from all these stuff that goes on out there. How awesome is that?
That is awesome. That's the why. I love it. Yeah. It kind of speaks to the post that I even put up today talking about like finding power in the pain, you know? How do you do that? Well, you acknowledge the fact that the pain was real. It's not fake. But at the same time, you know, that's kind of like the old term of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And if you have a good heart, then you will help other people minimize the pain, not necessarily avoid it because, hey, pain is actually a part of life. Pain means growth. But I think that's a good grounding. And I'm glad that you shared that about your own personal experience in the financial side of things, because it gives people some grounding of, you know, you've been through the highs and the lows and everything in between. So, and that's an important piece. That's how we learn to trust others is right. Is their
absolutely.
Willingness to say that out loud. Okay. I lied. I got one more question for you, Michael, and then we'll wrap here. What is the one thing that you are most grateful for? I got to ask that one. It's right up on the poster right there. So I got to ask that question.
It's gotta be my wife, Ann.
Why is that?
I mean, obviously my family and, you know, I was really tight with my dad, but my wife, she's just incredible. You know, so we had a little date. I told you we had like our own little date night last night. And, you know, we've been married for 26, almost 27 years. So, you know, it gets a little challenging to keep the spark going at times. And especially in these last couple of years where we've been kind of home together all the time.
You know, I can relate.
We started to take trips like last time. And we went to Hawaii, you know, that's where I got the cool shirt a couple months ago. And she's real. I'm so grateful for her, you know, my two beautiful children. And I was just, when my dad died, I mentioned that he died a few years after we started that business together in 93. And he was my best friend. And we were in the car last night. And I'm just remembering how she just took care of me. I mean, I was a mess. Because he died in the house, and you know we tried to revive him. I thought I brought him back. You know, he'd had a massive heart attack, and he actually opened his eyes, and then we lost him. And so I was a wreck for a long time, and she nurtured me back to, you know, as a 29-year-old man. You know, so I'm really grateful that she's married up, Harvard graduate, you know, smarter than me, a little bit smarter. Well. It's close, but she's got her own thing in a sort of healing space, sort of a healing / sales space, and so I have to go with her. And my daughters, of course, but I have to go with her for now. It's just one. And I almost blew that back. We dated for like a few months back in, you know, 91 or 2, whatever it was, and I was not in that mode. I was like, it's time for this to end. And that's how they all go. You know, it's a few months and then the next one. And I almost lost her. And it was actually in a weird sort of way, my dad's death brought us together. Because we were not together at that time. You know, we had kind of broken up, or I had broken up with her. And she really took care of me. And I'm truly grateful for
that. That's a great answer. And it's actually a good kind of analogy, metaphor, whatever you want to call it, for what we're talking about here. Because it's, you know, through death, we actually get an opportunity for rebirth. You know, if we're going to go deep and talk spiritual here right now, and there's so many layers to that, even in what we're talking about, it's, you know, what do you believe to be true about creating wealth for you and your family, including generational wealth? Well, how about we divorce ourselves from the idea of what we think is possible, which means open your mind to what you possibly could do with something like what you've talked about here for the last hour. So I think that's a good way to wrap things. So thanks so much for doing this, Michael. Tell people how they can get in touch with you, find out more. I know you've got a lot of articles and blog posts, and you're creating content and putting it out into the world and speaking on stages and all of that. So let people know how they can connect.
I guess probably my website is michaelrhessian.com. I think it's www.michaelrhessian.com. Got a website and, yeah, that's probably the best way. I got a new. If you go on there now, my ebook is ready to go. It's What is Infinite Banking and Why Should You Care? And I think it's a really great 18-page short way to kind of read and get a further sense of what the stuff is all about. And that's a great place to go. And you can book a call and happy to chat. It's a great and fun topic to talk
Excellent.
About.
Well, I'll link all that stuff up. And yeah, I'm glad that that ebook's all done, because that's just another piece of the puzzle. Hopefully this interview, for anybody that's watching, it opens up your minds to that possibility. Go check out that ebook as well. And then, of course, follow Michael on LinkedIn too, because he's posting content pretty consistently there and speaking from the heart. And
yep. Yes. 3 days in a row at this point.
I know. I love it. It's such an amazing feeling when you start to get that momentum going on just showing up every single day, doesn't it? It just transfers into every other area of your life, personally, professionally, you name it. So, all right. Well, we'll keep going. Awesome. Thanks again for doing this, Michael, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Trevor Turnbull Show. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please consider subscribing on my YouTube channel and on your favorite podcast platform, and leave me a review. I'd love to hear from you. Now, until next time, remember, today is a beautiful day of opportunity. Trust that you're exactly where you're supposed to be right now. So be grateful, be curious, and be brave.